This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court breathed new life into hopes for a voter ID requirement in North Carolina. A previous law had been struck down by the courts because the court said it targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision. But the High Court declined to hear an appeal. Chief Justice Roberts said their decision was not based on the merits of the case. And that has given new hope for proponents of voter ID who have vowed to find another way to introduce the requirement. We're going to take a look at the Supreme Court's decision and what it may mean for voters here, and also get to explore a decision by the White House to set up a voter fraud commission. Despite a lack of any evidence of voter fraud anywhere in the nation, President Trump insists fraud is real, and this commission will explore those beliefs. Joining us now is Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Morning. Welcome.
Morning, as always.
He is in our studio here in Charlotte, while Mitch Kokai and Ted Shaw are with us from WUNC in Chapel Hill. Mitch Kokai is senior political analyst at the John Locke Foundation, and Ted Shaw is the Julius Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Civil Rights at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Tom, let me begin with you. Let's go back to North Carolina's original voter ID law that was struck down by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. What did that law mandate?
Well, this, let's define exactly how far back we go. We go back to 2013, and this was a bill that was passed by the Republican-controlled General Assembly and signed into law by then-Governor Pat McCrory, and it mandated a few things. First, and again, it is a broad bill, so I'm giving a very generalized key point summary. The first thing it required certain forms of voter ID to be presented at the ballot box in order for someone to be able to get a ballot to cast a vote. It also got rid of same-day registration and voting. It eliminated 7 days of early voting, and it made changes to who exactly could be pre-registered. Under prior law, 16 and 17-year-olds who would be 18 at the time of a general election, of any election, could be pre-registered to vote. This law ended that that pre-registration.
And the Fourth Circuit Court struck it down because they found that it targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision. That's a quote. Ted Shaw, why did they feel that way?
Well, the court was concerned about the ways in which the ability of African Americans to vote and the ways in which voter participation increased in the African American communities. Those ways were what was targeted, just as the legislature now has the ability, when it redistricts, to be very surgical, to borrow from the Fourth Circuit, in terms of redistricting. So here, with respect to the measures that you talked about, the measures that had a positive impact on black voter participation were exactly those measures that the legislature targeted. And so the Fourth Circuit saw this as an indication of the legislature's intent. And so that's why they used that phrase, which was in the minds of many, a remarkable phrase.
And, yeah, let me just add on to what Ted just said there. One point in particular which illustrates Ted's point is what's known as souls to the polls. This is Sunday early voting, and it's something that African-American churches, or predominantly African-American churches, had used a lot. Under this law, it eliminated or allowed counties to eliminate certain Sundays where souls to the polls would be active, and that was one of the motions, or one of the things that the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals noticed and commented on, which led to the almost surgical precision line.
And Mitch Kokai, North Carolina GOP lawmakers here and lawmakers in other states, particularly those states controlled by Republican legislatures, when they gained the power of those state legislatures beginning around 2010, found it necessary to enact laws like North Carolina's. Why? What's the driving force behind this?
Well, you'd have to ask them what the driving force was, but I think at least part of this, the voter ID piece, which is the piece of this law that attracted most of the attention, was something that has broad bipartisan support and has broad support among various racial and ethnic groups as well. Going back to answer the first question that you posed, why did the Fourth Circuit refer to this as almost surgical precision? You have to distinguish what the Fourth Circuit did with what the U.S. District Court judge did. Mm-hmm. Judge Schroeder looked at this case, same set of facts, came out with a decision that was well over 400 pages and found that there was no violation, no intent of racial discrimination. What the Court of Appeals did was basically say, well, that's nice, Judge Schroeder. It's interesting that you looked at all of these facts of the case, but you looked in the wrong places. And what they did was look at North Carolina's history of racial discrimination and at the timing of the bill that came out of the General Assembly, that the various elements that were thrown together, voter ID, the same-day registration, early voting, all of those pieces were thrown together right after, within a couple of days, of a previous Supreme Court ruling. Mm-hmm. And people who were advocating against the voter ID law said, look, this is a sign. The General Assembly took its cue from a Supreme Court ruling and said, aha, the door is open for us now to target these groups that we don't want to vote, and we're going to throw all of these things into this bill. And that was an argument that swayed the judges on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. So I think the interest in doing something about voter integrity predates the 2010 election. It was just that 2010 was the election that brought Republicans to power in many of these states.
And Tom, we talked about what the original court decision was and how the appeals court overturned it. What exactly happened with the Supreme Court? Because they decided not to take the case. They didn't rule on the case at all.
Yeah, and I actually think, it's unusual. It's not completely uncommon, but it's unusual for the Chief Justice, in this case John Roberts, to issue the statement which he issued over this on Monday. And basically what he said is, look, there's been a blizzard of filings over who has standing to bring this case to the Supreme Court. Because of that, because of what is in essence kind of confusion over who has the right to keep this appeal going, they punted on the case. The Supreme Court punted here. And that means that the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling stands. Now,
why does it matter that there's a blizzard of individuals or entities filing one way or the other in a court case? Why does that matter?
It matters greatly because of something that's known as standing.
Okay.
And what standing means is you have the right to either sue, file charges, or in this case, file an appeal. And I don't think anybody will be surprised to hear that courts are very specific on these issues. Entire appeals can be won or lost over whether or not you have standing. So what happened originally with this appeal after the Fourth Circuit ruled last July is you had then Republican Governor Pat McCrory and the Republican-controlled General Assembly file this appeal. Since that time, you now have the former Attorney General, Roy Cooper. He was now the Democratic governor. Mm-hmm. And you have a new Democratic Attorney General, and they filed in February a move to take North Carolina's appeal off the table. The General Assembly, namely Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger and House Speaker Tim Moore, then filed, responded back saying, no, under our law, we think we still have the standing here. I know this is really confusing.
Don't they
but
all
that's
have
the
standing?
Point.
We have the governor, the Attorney General, and the people in the legislature.
The North Carolina To represent North Carolina, you have to have the right to do it in that appeal for the Supreme Court. And even the Supreme Court basically said, this is getting a little confusing, so we're not going to take this now.
At the time, our legislature and other GOP-controlled legislative bodies insisted that we needed these laws, these voter ID laws, to protect the integrity of elections and reduce voter fraud. That's been said many, many times. Is that what these efforts were? Or are they really a political maneuver to set up elections in a way that might benefit Republicans over Democrats?
Well, I'm assuming you want me to start with
that. Okay. I'll let you start. I'll let the other folks chime in.
Well, this goes actually back. I would offer two points here. This goes back to something Mitch was saying earlier as well when he was talking about the finding of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. And I do have to add on. I'm not disagreeing with what he's saying. I do have to add on one thing, though, and that is – the decision was not just based on North Carolina's history of voter suppression when it comes to specifically African Americans and Jim Crow laws. The court also looked at whether or not the state could prove voter fraud existed. That was contemporarily voter fraud existed. And that was a real key moment with both the opening and closing arguments. And in reality, the state could not prove that it did. When it came to voter ID, they could not prove that.
Well, Ted Shaw, you're the civil rights expert here, and you've seen a lot over the course of time with regard to civil rights. Was this a political maneuver either to disenfranchise black people or to disenfranchise either because they're black or because they tend to vote for Democrats? Or was this, in your opinion, a valid way to ensure the integrity of the election system?
Well, I want to speak to that. I want to go back, though, to something very quickly that Mitch said. He said that voter ID laws have broad bipartisan support and support throughout all kinds of communities, and I respectfully disagree with that representation. So I didn't want to leave that unchallenged. We could talk more about that. But I also want to say that with respect to Chief Justice Roberts and his comments on the denial of review, denial of cert, as it's called, usually the Supreme Court doesn't comment when it denies review. But any denial of review, any denial of certiorari, as it's called, that is, the certiorari is a term which says basically send the record up to the court so we can review it from the lower courts. But any denial is not on the merits. The only thing that's on the merits is a decision by the court if they address the merits. And so there's nothing unusual about that. What's unusual here is that the Chief Justice is sending a signal which says to those who oppose or rather who support voter ID that, there are some of us on the court who are likely to be more sympathetic to your appeal. So don't misunderstand us. That happens from time to time. I can think about another important civil rights case some years ago in which Justice Ginsburg did something similar involving the University of Texas and diversity in admissions. So back to the point about whether this is political. Of course, it's political. The nature of voting and all these concerns are political. Is it racial? I'm afraid that it is. It is almost impossible in this country right now, anybody who's honest or candid about it, to separate out race from partisan politics. And that's unfortunate, but that's the reality. Whether or not the motivations of the legislature are racist or not is a question that goes really beyond the one that I just teed up. And it's difficult in most instances to prove racially discriminatory intent. The important thing that you all have already mentioned is that all of this voter ID law, the civil rights advocates within the state call it the monster voter suppression law. But all of this happened after the Supreme Court struck down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which required review of changes in electoral schemes in states that had a history of voter discrimination against African-Americans or Latinos.
So that gave them license to enact these laws. That would not have been possible under these older restrictions. I have 10 seconds. Is that correct?
That's correct. Okay. Absolutely correct.
Ted Shaw is with us, director of the Center for Civil Rights at UNC Chapel Hill, with Mitch Kokai from John Locke Foundation. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Taylor Richards and Conger, a specialty shop for men built and headquartered in Charlotte, featuring European and American tailored clothing and accessories. Phillips Place, next to Dean and DeLuca. Details at trcstyle.com. And Bojangles, presenting the new Chicken Supreme Sandwich with bacon, dill pickles, and sweet sauce, served all day, every day at area Bojangles. You know something? The friendly skies don't seem so friendly anymore, do they? It's become increasingly unpleasant to fly, and recent incidents, including a passenger being hauled off an airplane, have made the going in the airline industry anything but great. Washington has taken notice, too, as just as the summer travel season is set to start. Are these recent high-profile incidents indicative of larger problems in the industry, or are they exceptions to the norm? The state of air travel. We'll talk about that tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, intelligence sharing between nations as we learn more about the charge that President Trump revealed classified information to Russia. We'll have the latest. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
You can join On Point right after Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News. And also with us, Mitch Kokai, the senior political analyst with the John Locke Foundation, and Ted Shaw, the Julius Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Civil Rights at UNC Chapel Hill. Ted Shaw just mentioned the fact that these voter ID laws here and around the country that came into being several years ago and have been struck down by various courts came into being primarily in the South, where states had been under supervision by the federal government. And
suddenly it's called preclearance.
And the Supreme Court said that no longer had to be, that all these reasons for those laws being that supervision to be in place no longer existed. Jim Crow was long gone, and now they could do what they wanted to on their own. So could it be argued, and this happened very quickly, these laws happened very quickly after that was taken off the books. Could it be argued, Mitch, that the hasty passage of these new voter ID laws here and in other states and the fact that an appeals court determined that our law here targeted African Americans be proof that the restrictions were, in fact, and continue to be necessary?
Well, I think you have to clarify exactly what the court ruled, because what the court ruled was that the preclearance provisions were out of date, that Congress had never gone back and looked to see whether the initial states and in some places counties within states, whether they still had the racially polarized voting that would require them to continue to need preclearance. So the court never said there is no need for preclearance anymore. What it said was, we're going to throw out these standards that were set decades ago because no one has ever gone back to see whether the preclearance is still needed in these particular places. And because of the polarized Congress, no one expects that Congress is going to go back and pass a new law that would set new boundaries on where preclearance is required. So the de facto situation is you're going to be in a situation where there's no preclearance until if they ever get to a point where Congress can come to an agreement about where it's needed. So the restrictions, whether they're needed or not, that was not something that the court decided. But back to an earlier point.
Well, I respectfully disagree with that representation. Congress went back and looked at the expiring provisions of the Voting Rights Act. Not all of the Voting Rights Act provisions are permanent for reasons that we could talk about. And Section 5 was one of the most important ones. Section 4 is actually what the court struck down in Shelby County, which is the coverage formula. But the court did exactly what you said it didn't do. The court did say that the formula was no longer good, and it did that in the face of the fact that Congress, both the House and the Senate, did hold extensive hearings. I know because, among other reasons, I was involved deeply in those reconsiderations of the Voting Rights Act and the expiring provisions. And so Congress determined that, looking at the record, that it was important to maintain those provisions, that there was a continuing need for it. And the Chief Justice and four others determined that Congress was wrong in its interpretation and what it did. So respectfully, I have another take on that, and think that that's exactly what Congress did. Chief Justice Roberts has a long history of hostility to the Voting Rights Act that we can talk about. So that was no surprise, just as it was no surprise that he said what he did on Monday.
Yeah, I don't think we're saying a different thing. What I'm saying is that the Supreme Court disagreed that Congress, in its decision to keep the same counties and the same states under preclearance, I believe the Supreme Court said, hey, this is outdated. You've not proven that you've gone back to show that these exact counties that are under preclearance and these exact states that are under preclearance should still be under preclearance. Now, we can disagree, and I don't even have an opinion one way or the other about whether these are the correct counties or the correct states to be under preclearance. What the Supreme Court said was that Congress had not done an adequate job of reviewing it again. So I was just trying to say that the Supreme Court did not say that there's no need for preclearance and this goes away completely. What the Supreme Court said was that Congress, in its view, the Supreme Court's view, and as you mentioned, it was a split vote, probably 5-4, said that the Congress had not done an adequate job of going back and proving that those same places needed preclearance.
Mitch, when you were on this program, I think it was August of 2016, and I think it was recent, in light of the appeals court striking down the law, you said that in doing so, the court basically said, facts be damned, and turned their attention to our state's history of discrimination and the impact of race on politics, and you called that disappointing. Why?
It was disappointing because Judge Schroeder had put together such a lengthy record of looking at all of the facts in the case and coming up with this conclusion that, no, there is no sign that this was racially motivated. And instead of picking apart Judge Schroeder's arguments and saying, no, you're wrong here, you're wrong here, you're wrong here, instead, the judges basically said, well, it's nice that Judge Schroeder came up with this 480-page decision, but he missed the point. And the point is North Carolina has this history of racial discrimination in voting. Plus, as you alluded to, we've actually mentioned this now a couple of times, the bill that came out of the General Assembly came out, it was filed, the details came out within days of this Supreme Court ruling on the preclearance. And so that, in and of itself, was proof to the judges on the Court of Appeals that there was some sort of animus and some sort of racial motive. And I would have rather have seen them take what Judge Schroeder wrote, and if he was wrong, tell him why he was wrong, rather than saying, no, we're going to set aside your finding of facts and instead look at this history and our interpretation of what the General Assembly was up to.
So the fact that the Supreme Court has declined to hear this and that declination was not made on the merits of the case, which, Ted Shaw, you say is a signal coming from Judge Roberts to the rest of the world that the court might be open to hearing the right kind of case and that there would be a friend on the court to hear those cases. Let me be clear.
The fact that it didn't hear it doesn't send that signal. As I say, that says nothing about the merits. What sends that signal
the fact that he said the merits.
The Chief Justice said.
Yeah, that was what I was trying to say. That because he made a point of saying that this is not being held on the merit, not being heard because of the merits of the case, leaves the door open to hearing something that would be heard on the merits of the case. That's given hope to a lot of GOP lawmakers out there who want to find a way to do this again.
We haven't mentioned this yet, but it's probably important to note that the Supreme Court has dealt with voter ID before. The Supreme Court upheld a voter ID law in Indiana, and there are some people among those who think North Carolina needs voter ID who have said all along, even back when this original bill came into being, why don't you just put into place a voter ID law that's similar to what Indiana has because it has withstood Supreme Court scrutiny rather than throwing in a bunch of different things.
Well, and let me step in here, too, just really quickly. Mitch is right. That Supreme Court has upheld an Indiana case. And
what's the difference?
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to get to. And in a way, the General Assembly did try to morph the ID rules from the original 2013 bill while this was being litigated in order to better fit that, because it was clear that this was a point of contention and problem with the court. And so it basically created a standard or a couple of different ways where if you could fill a reasonable impediment as to why you don't have an ID, you did not have transportation, you could, you know, there was a list of approved reasons, you could then cast a provisional ballot. But, you know, again, to get back to kind of the core issue here, there's a lot of interpretations here. Both Ted and Mitch have clear interpretations. They both absolutely have their merits. I'm going to let them stand on what they said. But the key thing here for proponents of voter ID, it has moved on now from North Carolina to a case in Texas. Indiana's decision, while yes upheld, was rather narrow in scope. That's why the North Carolina decision may have gotten heard in the first place. So now that North Carolina is off the table, and it's not completely off the table, but most people agree it's going to take something rather creative in order for the General Assembly to get it back before the court, all eyes turn to Texas. And the difference with the Texas law is North Carolina's kind of wrapped all of these different provisions into a great big package. Most other states are passing it more piecemeal. The Texas bill, I believe, is more specific to voter ID than North Carolina's, which had all of these other provisions, the early voting, the pre-registration, you know, all those kinds of things. And it is still seen, and I think this is still important to note, even though I've said it before, the Fourth Circuit's decision was not just based on history. Yes, that was absolutely a key part of it. But again, the three-judge panel disagreed with Judge Schroeder, the district judge, because they continue to look for proof of voter fraud. And the state, they argue, the justices argue, or the judges argue, could not provide that. And therefore, they fell back on intent, and the intent they found in their eyes was clearly discriminatory.
So both sides have found rays of sunshine in this. Governor Cooper called this announcement of the court's decision not to hear the case good news for North Carolina voters. State Republican Party Chair Robin Hayes said that while Governor Cooper and Attorney General Josh Stein have stymied voter ID for now, they will ultimately lose in their efforts to block North Carolina citizens from having these protections. That's a quote. And General Assembly House Speaker Tim Moore and President Pro Tem Senator Phil Berger vowed to continue fighting to protect the integrity of our elections by implementing the common sense requirement to show a photo ID when we vote. Has there been any? Go ahead.
Well, let's get right to the core of this. The Indiana case, yes, the Supreme Court decided that way. Of course, I think that it was wrong to do so. And Justice Stevens, who was on the court at that point and voted with the majority after he retired, said that he wished that he had voted the other way. And one of the esteemed justices, or judges rather, on the Seventh Circuit also said he would have reconsidered it, his vote. But let me come back to this issue. This has been a problem or solution rather in search of a problem, it's been called. There is no evidence of widespread voter fraud here in North Carolina or anywhere in the country. And so I think that most people know exactly what this is about, and that's what the court was also indicating in the Fourth Circuit. You know, the issue of pretext is an old one in civil rights cases. If you don't have a legitimate reason and you make an argument that doesn't hold water, it's a basis for the courts to be able to point to some other intent that may be struck down as problematic, illegal, et cetera. And that's exactly what the court did here. In the Fourth Circuit. You're right to point to Texas. That's where the current litigation is with respect to voter ID laws. We could say a lot more about how Texas crafted their law that indicated discriminatory intent also.
But former Governor Pat McCrory, at the time this Fourth Circuit struck down the law, said photo IDs are required to purchase Sudafed to cash a check, to board an airplane, or enter a federal courtroom. So given that, what's so onerous about having a voter ID or a picture ID to vote?
Well, I'll tell you what I think is problematic about it. When we talk about buying Sudafed, that doesn't have either civil rights or constitutional dimensions to it. The right to vote is sacred in this country, and it ought to be treated that way. When we think about the right to vote, when you have these efforts that are being made, whether they're being made on partisan grounds or whether they're being made on racial grounds, we ought to not simply accept laws that attempt to drive people away from the exercise of their right to engage in civic participation. You know, I think about my own grandmother, long gone. She never could find her her birth certificate. She voted every year of her life that she could vote, and she worked hard to find that birth certificate. Mm-hmm. Couldn't find it. It had been destroyed in a fire in the courthouse. There are all kinds of reasons why poor people may not have voter IDs. You know, my analogy is this. We watched as people tried to get out of New Orleans as Katrina was approaching. We watched those long lines of vehicles, and we assumed that everybody was going to get out. We were wrong about that. Not everybody was able to get out. The way we assume the abilities of all Americans to have certain privileges and advantages often is blown up by the facts and by experience. And that's similar with respect to the exercise of the right to vote. When we elevate a picture ID, which many poor people don't have, over the right to vote, I think that that's tragic, but often it's also disingenuous with respect to motivations.
You have said, Ted, and other people have said this as well, many people have said this, there's no example of voter fraud anywhere in the country. But the Civitas Institute...
There have been instances
of voter fraud in the country. What the statement I think you're trying to make is that it's not on a scale that has influenced a national election or most races. I can point to the fact, I mean, the North Carolina State Board of Elections just last month released their report on the 2016 elections, and they found 508 voters who were not eligible to vote cast ballots. Now, in some interpretation, can call that fraud.
Okay,
but
yeah, this is one of the problems in this discussion. Professor Shaw was very correct in saying no evidence of widespread voter fraud. I heard him say that, and he's exactly right. There is no evidence of widespread voter fraud. Some people take that too far to say no evidence of voter fraud at all. And it's very easy to go into localities in North Carolina, across the country, and find examples here and there of voter fraud. But I think everyone who has said that there is no evidence of widespread voter fraud has been correct. I think one of the key things that supporters of voter ID requirements have said is that one of the problems with the system that we have now is that there is too much opportunity for fraud and that it's hard to detect. And so we don't know whether there's widespread fraud. So exactly, there's no evidence of widespread fraud. Supporters have said the door is too far open to that fraud. I mean, there was a Pew Research study back in 2012, and this is not a right-wing group. This is the Pew Charitable Trust. They determined that 1 out of 8 American voter registrations is inaccurate. Does that mean that 1 out of 8 votes is a fraudulent vote? I'm certain that that's not true. But if you see that number and you think that in a state like North Carolina, there is no requirement for people to show they are who they say they are when they go to vote, it makes you think. Now, is the voter ID law that North Carolina put in place a great law? Maybe not. But that the motivation for people supporting this issue is let's ensure we have as much integrity in the process as possible.
Mitch Kokai, a senior political analyst with the John Locke Foundation. Ted Shaw is here from UNC Chapel Hill and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. We will continue in just a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru Gastonia, featuring the new Outback with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. And Central Piedmont Community College's STEM Summer Experience, offering summer camps for elementary to high school students. Details at STEMSummerExperience.com. Another day, another bombshell out of the White House. The latest, a memo from ousted FBI Director James Comey that says President Trump asked Comey to stop the investigation into Michael Flynn, the president's former national security advisor. It's more grist for the comparisons to Watergate, and some are asking if the president is obstructing justice. That question will be pondered on point coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock with guest host Jane Clayson. And we will continue our conversation in just a moment. Stay with us.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Rebels in Colombia have stopped fighting a civil war. Some have not stopped the...
It's your community. we help you understand it.
Murder, robbery, assault, and other violent crimes had been on the decline in Charlotte and across the U.S. over the past decade or so. More recently, it's been ticking back up, and CMPD is...
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Supreme Court and its declining to hear the case challenging the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals striking down North Carolina's voter ID law. And that does, some people feel, open the door to new legislation in North Carolina. And we're joined now by Republican State Senator Jeff Tarte from District 41. Senator, thank you for joining us.
Mike, thanks for having me on. And before we start, just wanted to make sure the listeners are aware of Senator Tillis's health issue, and hopefully he will be fine and we keep him in our prayers.
Yeah.
All right. In an editorial in the Charlotte Observer, the paper advised those inclined to hoist a toast to the Supreme Court for their decision not to hear an appeal to the Fourth Circuit Court's decision on our voter ID laws to, quote, drink fast. Have there been, are there now, plans in the legislature to craft new voter registration or voter legislation?
Yeah, and listening to the topic a little bit, the listeners need to be clear, Mike, that there's a distinction and delineation between voter ID and the election laws. Having read the opinion from the Fourth Appellate Court, it's an 80-plus page document. I've read it multiple times. Nowhere in that document does it strike down anything regarding voter ID. We have 33 states that have voter identification requirements, so it's well-established and very acceptable. What the court had issues with were some of the procedural changes and rules around the election laws. So, you know, what we do and craft around voter ID, I assume we will continue to address that issue. What we do around election laws is always a topic of discussion for sure.
Have those discussions already started? Knowing what you know about the appeals court's decision, have you already taken a look at what you could do to have a voter ID law but change it in a way that would pass the test?
Yeah, I think you look at all the options, too. You know, if voter ID is really critically important, which at least I personally believe it's something we should have for various reasons, then voter fraud is not the driver for me at all. But to put something like that in place, if you really want to pass it, I think you could pull it out separately and run it independently from the election laws. In 2013, we had a bill that I was one of the three primary sponsors on that I believe would be accepted. Interestingly enough, the other two senators who were sponsors were African-American Democrats, Joel Ford and Ben Clark, and the three of us put our heads together and came up with something I believe is very pragmatic and thoughtful in that area.
So what would that look like?
Basically, it would look like our voter ID bill without the election laws amended to it.
Okay, because Robin Hayes, the GOP party chair, has insisted that the invalidated provisions in that law were common sense voting protections. Do you agree with that? And would you try to work them back into any new legislation in some way?
Well, there'll be individual members who will have an interest in you know, linking the election law changes with voter ID. And you have to pragmatically think through what's appropriate, what will, you know, pass mustered with the courts, what's appropriate constitutionally, what does not infringe or disenfranchise any voters. We should never do that in any way, shape, or form. So obviously it'll be a topic of discussion. As far as Chairman Hayes' comments, it's hard to broad brush because that bill on the election laws has multiple components, and there's some of the things I agree with and some of them I don't.
So how do you gain the trust of people who see these attempts to pass voter ID laws and change voting hours and things like that as an attempt to disenfranchise voters? How do you gain their trust and say, we're really just trying to ensure the integrity of the vote?
Well, I think the biggest thing when you have bills like this, at least my personal preference, was you got to get all the stakeholders at the table. Everybody needs to have a chair sitting around the table and being able to discuss the various aspects of the law, and you need to be able to justify, explain them. Mm-hmm. They need to be pragmatic, thoughtful, and rigorous, and everybody has to, at some point, come to consensus and agree what's the right things to continue to move forward. If you have things that are going to be contentious, then you got to step back and ask, really, does it make sense to do some of those things?
These laws sprang up very quickly all over the South a couple of years ago, and there have only been a tiny number of cases. There have been cases of actual voter fraud. I stand corrected on this, but there have only been a tiny number of them when you look at the millions of votes cast every election season around the country. So many see this simply as a thinly veiled attempt to make it more difficult for certain segments of the population to vote. Explain why it is not that.
Well, I don't know if I'm the expert on this. We're actually going to be sitting down with the state director from the State Board of Elections to look at some of the anomalies in the voting numbers to try to understand how do we improve that system. Because fundamentally what it should be, everybody who is authorized to vote, and that being people who can demonstrate citizenship and residency, should in no way impede or prevent anyone from casting a vote. As you talked about earlier on the show, that's a basic civil right that's guaranteed to everybody that is immutable. Everybody that should be allowed to vote. Those that, however, that don't meet that criteria should not be allowed to vote. It's kind of black and white. So
one of the things we haven't talked about here is that the United States has always prided itself on its election system and the integrity of its elections and the integrity of the people who win the offices for which they run through these elections, and the constant focus on and constant harping on the lack of integrity in our elections and how that we are threatened by tons of voter fraud and dead people voting and people who have no reason to vote, immigrants voting who are not citizens. Doesn't that undermine the public perception of the integrity of our elections and therefore the integrity of those who are in the offices they hold?
You know, Mike, I'm sure there's people that would try to make that case, but I think the other side of that coin is, you know, that we stay diligent that way. People keep it in the forefront of discussion. You know, sometimes it's the vitriol and the hyperbole that gains the most attention. But we also have a responsibility, like I said, to be diligent, thorough, rigorous, to ensure the integrity of all elections. And, you know, I don't think there's, as we've said, any proof of widespread voter fraud, but we got people casting votes that shouldn't be in a small scale. And one is too many, and if we also prevent one person from voting that should have, that's just as bad.
Why is this so important to Republicans, but apparently not to Democrats?
You know, I don't know. You know, I really don't have a sense. Again, when we introduced the bill in 2013 with Senator Ford and Clark, we had a bipartisan support for the whole voter ID requirement. So I think there's widespread fundamental agreement that can be reached on that topic. I think the other things that get more complicated are the specifics around the election laws.
Ted Shaw, you wanted to jump in here. I could hear you.
Well, I want to say a couple of things. One is that there is no evidence of widespread voter fraud, and there's almost no evidence of in-person voter fraud. I would not say it never happens, but it is exceedingly rare. There are issues with respect to just maintaining up-to-date roles, deaths, moves, confusion. You know, people with the same name, often some of the people who point to voter fraud are actually talking about some people who may have the same name as other individuals. So there's a lot of confusion. It's legitimate to try to address those problems. But this issue of voter ID goes to contentions that there is in-person voter fraud. And that simply isn't so. And I think we have to balance off, you know, the senator says that one instance is enough or more than enough or something to that effect. Sure, we want to have clean voter participation, but I think we have to balance off the effects of these voter ID laws and the North Carolina law that was struck down when, as we talked about, well beyond voter ID. We have to balance all that off and look at the effect it has on participation within communities, and particularly within African-American communities, where there's a long history that is continuing in places of trying to keep them from exercising the ballot.
Tom.
And the reality is that partisan politics is a big part of that. So while the senator respectfully doesn't see that as the issue, he says, I think that there is evidence that there are differences between how Democrats vote, how Republicans vote by definition, and the connection between race and partisan politics. As I said, that's unfortunate, but that's the reality. But that shouldn't lead us to engage in discrimination against any group on the grounds of race, or for that matter, partisanship.
Tom. I just want to add on to a little bit of what Professor Shaw was saying and also what Senator Tartt was saying. I think part of the problem here and the reason you see less Democratic support on this issue, and I'm not surprised that the pendulum has moved there, is the us against them perception. Mm-hmm. Just look at this. I'll again add a specific to what Professor Shaw was saying. This voter law specifically targeted one area, let's say, in-person early voting, souls to the polls. Those predominantly are done by African Americans or other minorities. But they absolutely left untouched absentee mail-in ballots. And studies have shown, in fact, you know, we actually saw two cases of voter fraud in North Carolina in 2016 that involved in-person absentee ballots, where someone had died and a family member signed off on their name and put in their absentee ballot. Now, neither of those are going to be prosecuted. They weren't deemed to be, you know, malicious. But it's easy to get that us against them when you see, well, Republicans tend to mail in their ballots and that's being left untouched. Mm-hmm. And Democrats often like to go on Sundays and that's being touched. It's easy to set up a partisan divide.
And Senator, to Ted Shaw's point, according to The Observer, the State Board of Elections conducted an extensive audit following the 2016 election and found that out of 4.8 million votes cast, only one would probably have been avoided with a voter ID law. So given that and the fact that other states have produced similar numbers, is this really about election integrity, and is it really worth the effort?
Well, I would contend yes, because one of the things that helps is just the whole management on election day at the polls themselves. I'll give you one example in my home precinct, and where a voter ID would have helped clarify it, and it can streamline the process. We had a gentleman come to vote, and he said he'd already cast a vote. And it's like, really? I'm standing right in front of you, and I did not vote earlier, as you say I did. Turns out it was his son, because he was junior and senior, and they marked the wrong one, you know, because looking at IDs and stuff would obviously help clarify some of that as they go through it. So there's things it can improve with that. There's a reason 33 states have voter ID. I think there's things to get people on the rolls accurately. There's things I would like to see us do, like at age 16 when you get your driver's license, when you present, you know, proper identification of citizenship and residency, you do there, you'd automatically be registered to vote. Mm-hmm. Why not? We've got technology headed where I'd love to see us issue digital certificates to every individual at 16 and above. That gives you absolute security in your identification. And that would enable us to vote anywhere from any location with a digital certificate to prove your identity without people being able to circumvent the system.
So how quickly...
There's technology coming to help us improve this whole process.
How quickly can we anticipate something coming out of Raleigh with regard to voter ID legislation?
You know, I think we'll continue to work at it. I don't know if there'll be something still this session that we address it or not, but I'm sure there are people that will look at it. We have an elections law committee, so... I know the topic will be taken up. What and how it gets approached is something we all got to pay attention to.
Republican State Senator Jeff Tartt from District 41. Thank you very much for joining us, Senator. I appreciate it.
You're quite welcome, Mike.
By the way, he mentioned Senator Tom Tillis, who collapsed this morning during a race in Washington. Senator Tillis has just tweeted, "I'm doing well, looking forward to getting back to work. Thanks for all your prayers and well wishes." He says he just got overheated during that run. I want to turn, we only have a couple of minutes left, but I want to talk just for a second or two, a kind of a sidebar issue. President Trump has created a commission to examine voter fraud and voter suppression after repeatedly claiming without evidence that fraudulent voting constitutes a major and ongoing problem in the United States. What will the function of this committee be, Tom?
Well, to get to the bottom of whatever the voting systems are. I mean, the funny thing is the executive order, if you read it, which I've done, it's not all that specific. President Trump has said that it was going to, the commission will look into his claim that he would have won the popular vote were it not for apparently more than 3 million people, he believes, without evidence, voted illegally in the United States for Hillary Clinton. But the commission itself is just looking into any problems with the voting system. Now, there are all kinds of different things you could look into there. You could look into, should there be paper ballot trails? You can look into the technology. I mean, the fact that most voting machines in this country, you know, predate iPhones and possibly even iPods is concerning, especially when you start seeing, you know, their parts wear out and they don't have replacements.
So Vice President Pence will chair this commission. It will be co-chaired by the Secretary of State for the state of Kansas, Chris Kobach, who agrees with Trump's claims of rigged elections. Has any proof surfaced anywhere in the country that any election has been rigged?
I mean, sure. If you want to go back into historical perspectives, let's not forget Tammany Hall. That's exactly what actually did it. But in the modern day, it's possible at a low level, but on a national level, a state level, or any kind of significant race, all signs point to no. And Mitch or Ted, if you know of something, I'd love you to correct me, but that is my understanding.
Well, I'd love to leap in at this point with a sidebar point, and that is, I don't know anyone personally. I've never spoken to anyone who believes President Trump's claim that he would have won the popular vote if there hadn't been the 3 million or 5 million or whatever number he's thrown out of illegal votes cast for Hillary Clinton. I don't know anyone who believes that that is true. Now, on the flip side, I think that among the people who should support the work of this group, as long as the group works above board, people should be Democrats who have said there's no widespread voter fraud. Because if this group does its work correctly, they'll show there's no widespread voter fraud, and the Republicans will have to shut up about it. And
well, here's the problem.
No, I'm sorry. We are out of time. Completely out of time. I'm very sorry. Mitch Koch, I got the last word. Senior political analyst for the John Locke Foundation. Ted Shaw, director of the Center for Civil Rights and the Julius Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law at UNC Chapel Hill. And Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.